Hello, everybody. While we're waiting for people to file in, I'll waste the time with the introductions. This is Ian Williams, President of the Foreign Press Association. And to start the new year, we're very pleased to welcome back Ambassador John Bolton, who's in a sense on a roll with his subjects, because much of what he said is unrolling in front of us now, both in China, Ukraine, Afghanistan, and other places where he has warned against the perils of isolationism and also over-optimistic ideological transformations. His new article in the National Review, which I've just finished reading this morning, does a quick sweep of history, taking in the Battle of New Orleans and Teddy Roosevelt's Great White Stick. And I must say that Teddy Roosevelt is someone I often quote, because his one aphorism that really sticks over the years is that you should speak softly and carry a big stick. And people often sort of forget about the big stick when they advocate diplomacy. So, Ambassador, you are addressing isolation in the context of repeated failed votes in the Congress, a clear failure of any foresight of any kind, because these people were concentrating on very parochial issues. I'm not sure it's a good or a bad thing. There are no big ideological issues that we can see here. It's some form of inner GOP tribalism that was being exercised while the Republican, while the Democrats were standing by eating popcorn, as all the metaphors and the cartoons had it. So can you expound on your article in the National Review about how American foreign policy is conditioned by these neo-isolationist sentiments?
Right. Well, thanks very much for having me back. Happy New Year to everybody. And I thought it was appropriate to start off by talking about what the new Congress means, because we're also now clearly into the 2024 presidential campaign cycle, and obviously congressional elections for a third of the Senate and the House again in 2024. And there's a lot of media chatter, certainly in the United States, but really around the world, about what's going to happen politically in the United States in the 2023-2024 time period, who's going to get the Republican nomination for president, who's going to get the Democratic nomination for president, what's going to happen with respect to assistance to Ukraine, how are we going to deal with Russia and China. And honestly, there's a lot of nonsense out there about some of the politics, some of the political implications here in this country. And so, as I say, I'd be happy. I don't plan to go on for a huge amount of time here, and I'm happy to answer any questions any of you may have, but I wanted to set the scene, so to speak, and that's really what I tried to do in this National Review article, and I've sent it to Ian. Ian, I don't know if you can get it to your members, but it's on the National Review website. If you're not subscribers, by all means, subscribe so you can get through the paywall. I'll warn you in advance, it's long. For an article, it's about something over 4,500 words. It's not obviously book length, but it's long enough that it's not a normal op-ed. Again, because I thought this required some explanation, and so the issue that prompted me to get into it was the idea that the several mistaken ideas that Donald Trump is still the dominant force within the Republican Party, that he'll be the nominee in 2024. That he has a philosophy, and that there are others in the party who share that philosophy, whatever it is, specifically as it applies to American foreign policy. And what I say in this piece at greater length is, there has long been a fringe isolationist element in the Republican Party. There's also a fringe isolationist element in the Democratic Party, too. They come at it from different sides of the political spectrum, although ironically, they often end up in the same place. And this isolationist impulse, you know, you can debate definitions and taxonomies forever. Well, this guy's an isolationist, but this one isn't. I don't really find that a very profitable enterprise. I think the core isolationist impulse, certainly among conservatives, but on the left as well, is the rest of the world doesn't matter. It only matters what happens in the United States. And that's where we should have our focus, and for different reasons, not worry about the rest of the world. The left thinks the United Nations will take care of the rest of the world. The right doesn't really, the isolationists on the right don't really care who takes care of the rest of the world. But I think the isolationist notion itself rests on a fundamental fallacy, and that is a history, a narrative, that again, ironically, the left and the right join on, is that for well over a century, America existed in a perfect world protected by two broad oceans. We sat by our fireside knitting. We didn't much care about the rest of the world until first St. Woodrow Wilson, followed by St. Franklin Roosevelt, pulled us kicking and screaming into internationalism in the 20th century, from which the isolationists are now trying to retreat. This is a fundamentally misconceived view of American history. It may be disappointing to some Europeans, but my perspective is that the United States, from its inception, has been pushing itself into the outside world, in some cases, whether the outside world was interested in it or not. In fact, after the Treaty of Versailles in 1783 confirmed our independence, the financier of the American Revolution and others put together a ship launched in 1783 called the Empress of China, which sailed in early 1784 for China, making its first appearance as an American vessel there. We fought a quasi-war, as it was called, with France, a naval war in the late 1790s against French privateers. We, the United States, fought the Barbary pirates in North Africa from 1801 forward because the Europeans wouldn't do it. They preferred to pay tribute and ransom. We didn't accept that. That's where our slogan, millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute, comes from. But from our earliest days, we were fighting in North Africa. That's where the line in the Marines hymn, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, 1801. Beyond that, we purchased Louisiana from the French in 1803, doubling the size of the country there. We fought the War of 1812, as Ian referenced, confirming our independence and defeating the British, although it was after the peace treaty, but obliterating essentially the British army at the Battle of New Orleans. We then fought the Mexican War to get the southwestern United States. Split the northwest, the northwestern part of the continent with Britain to finalize the northern boundary. Bought several hundred thousand acres just to put a railroad through in the Gadsden Purchase of 1853. We paused to fight a civil war in this country, but we didn't slow down. In 1867, Seward's Icebox, Alaska, we purchased from Russia. For a pittance, and not a bad thing to have done if you consider the later Cold War period during the 20th century. Then we had an enormous period of industrialization that expanded our trade all over the world. You know, in the meantime, the United States had a Pacific squadron in the early 1800s. Even though we had no states on the Pacific Ocean, we fought a battle in Sumatra in Indonesia in 1830. We had South Atlantic squadrons. We were really all over the world, including in the days of Henry Cabot Lodge in his early incarnation in the Senate, taking Hawaii to make sure the British didn't get it, to set up a system of continental defense. In 1898, we fought the Spanish Empire, what was left of it, defeated them in Cuba, took Guam, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, and Cuba for a time. All of this before Woodrow Wilson was doing anything other than lecturing to students at Princeton University. And that really, it's the Lodge, Theodore Roosevelt view of the world versus the Wilsonian view of the world that I think really sets the tune for Republican and conservative foreign policy. Woodrow Wilson, the originator, at least the most prominent figure in the doctrine of liberal internationalism, another bumper sticker I don't like very much, but it was Woodrow Wilson who said, "We're fighting World War I to make the world safe for democracy." Well, Theodore Roosevelt had an answer to that. He said, "First, we are to make the world safe for ourselves." He said, "This is America's war, and if we don't fight it now, we'll have to fight it later." So I go through this, I call it a Calvin Coolidge-length history of the United States, because I think the whole notion that we were a stay-at-home, knit-by-the-fire, isolationist people who couldn't be troubled with the rest of the world, we weren't troubled by the rest of the world. We were troubling them and doing very well. Thank you very much. So this debate has enormous roots in American history. And the isolationists of today, I think, certainly on the Republican side, don't appreciate this history. They don't understand what it means to do strategic analysis. They don't spend any time on it. Their arguments are simplistic. They say, well, we're not controlling the southern border. Why should we worry about the border with Ukraine? As if a failure to handle one policy challenge, the southern border, excuses failing to deal with another foreign policy challenge, the unprovoked Russian aggression against Ukraine. They say, "What, we're spending all that money overseas when we could spend it at home." For Republicans, that's really ironic because we don't want to spend so much of it at home either. This is a question of priorities, and it's a question of a debate worth having. And I think you can see this is where the influence of Donald Trump has had an effect on the Republican Party, not in a principled way, But in a way of affecting people who are still trying to show loyalty to Trump, which is another irony, since his influence within the Republican Party is fading, I think fading ever more rapidly. I think politically speaking, he's in terminal decline at this point, will not be the nominee of the party in 2024. But this isolationist issue is something I think we should talk about, should debate in the 2024 nomination process. And I'll just tick through a bunch of issues very quickly. And again, happy to address any of them at greater length for those who would be interested. But the greatest example of the failure of Trumpian isolationism is the decision that the Biden administration carried through on to withdraw from Afghanistan and to have NATO withdraw as well. Suffering enormous setbacks in our ability to monitor terrorist activity in Afghanistan, nuclear programs on either side in Pakistan and Iran, opening that part of Central Asia to Chinese and Russian penetration, since any vacuum we create, somebody else is going to fill. Providing again safe haven for terrorists to come into Afghanistan, and by the way, Subjecting the population of Afghanistan to the return of the theological tyranny that the Taliban represents. That's what people want. That's what they think isolationism brings. Obviously, it puts America and America's friends at grave risk, and that's what's wrong with it. People talk about Iraq, for example, as Trump wanting to end the endless wars. Well, Obama wanted to do that too as a form of democratic isolationism. He called them forever wars, and he withdrew all American forces in 2011, only to have to return them a few years later, and where they still are because of the rise of ISIS. In fact, this was, I think, the refutation of the idea about how to end the forever wars, and we're still seeing the consequences of it today. Now, one example where Trump hasn't changed his mind was he still believes that the Iran nuclear deal was a bad idea. And it just shows this isolationist upsurge in the Republican Party is a function of Trump, because with Trump still saying he doesn't like the Iran nuclear deal, there's no dissent effectively in the Republican Party. And there's still enormous criticism of the Biden administration's efforts to go back into the 2015 nuclear deal. On Ukraine, this is probably the single most visible example of the debate over isolationism. And we just saw it over the weekend in the struggle to elect Kevin McCarthy Speaker of the House, where there's been, he has at least committed, he can't force the House, but he can commit to hold a vote on a budget level that the 20 who objected to his selection as Speaker wanted back at the fiscal year 2022 level, which if you interpret that back on defense spending means a pretty substantial cut from what was just appropriated by authorized by Congress for the coming fiscal year. Now, that doesn't mean that that's actually going to happen. It means there's going to be a vote on it. And I tell you, there will be, if you think this was messy last week, electing McCarthy Speaker, wait until the fight over that comes. It doesn't say anything about really the ultimate aggregate level of defense spending or anything specific like what assistance to Ukraine would be. But this is a good example of where the battle is being joined right now. I can tell you, among both Democrats and Republicans in the House, in the Senate, there remains overwhelming support for helping Ukraine. And I think that's reflected in a number of polls. Some say, but we're not going to give Ukraine a blank check. That's right. I don't want to give Ukraine a blank check. Nobody's asked for a blank check as far as I know. But this is where you need serious debate. And it's where the isolationists essentially fail because they don't do the necessary analysis. And then I'll just close on China, which I think is the existential threat of the 21st century. Even many of the isolationists say, well, we don't disagree on China, although they fail to note that Donald Trump had no time whatever for Taiwan. And I do worry a little bit that some of the isolationists are saying, yeah, China's a serious threat, which they'll say right up until we have to do something about it, which in fact we do. Japanese Prime Minister Kishida is visiting Washington. He'll be here on Friday to meet with President Biden. That was the subject of an op-ed I had in the New York Post today, which I would also encourage you to read. Maybe Ian can send that around too. But there are a number of issues involving what to do with the Asian Quad. We've seen the Japanese not waiting for the United States to exercise a little leadership. A few weeks ago, the Kishida government announced a doubling of Japan's defense budget over the next 5 years. Actually, it'll be more than doubling, but taking it from 1% to 2% of gross domestic product, which of course is coincidentally the NATO target, which will mean more than doubling in actual expenditures, presuming Japan's GDP increases in the next 5 years, which they certainly hope it will. But if they succeed, if they fulfill that commitment in 5 years, that will make Japan's military the third biggest in the world after only the United States and China. That's not a country that thinks peace and sweetness have broken out in East Asia, that's for sure. So there's a lot to discuss about how to deal with the Chinese threat, which really is whole of society. It's not just a military threat. It's not just a political threat. It is an economic threat. And I'd have to say, having watched this, the development of Chinese strategy for a long time, I've revised my own thinking about the nature of what the threat is. I believed back in the 1990s that Deng Xiaoping and the reformers really had cast Marxism aside as a governing philosophy, that they were certainly still authoritarians, but you had Deng Xiaoping saying it doesn't matter whether a cat is black or white as long as it catches mice, and it's glorious to be rich, and capitalists can join the Communist Party. I thought the ideology was simply a kind of formalism, a screen to be able to say we haven't really changed our minds, despite the fact we've abandoned Marxist economic principles for more free market-oriented principles. I think if you look at the past 3 or 4 years, in particular, at Xi Jinping and his activities, his effort to elevate himself to be the equivalent of Mao Zedong, to have Xi Jinping thought equivalent to Mao Zedong thought, which is equivalent to Marx and Lenin in the Chinese lexicon, and the way they talk about the ideology, the recentralization of political and economic power, which they're engaged in now under Xi Jinping. All leads me to conclude, really, they still believe in this ideology. It's evolved over the past 30 years, that's for sure. But it's not just some Chinese version of authoritarianism. It is Chinese Marxism, or Marxism with Chinese characteristics. And that sense of ideology, I think, is something that we need to take into account, and all of those along China's Indo-Pacific periphery need to take into account too. And again, why I think the 2024 election, I'm about to stop here, but the 2024 election in the US will be more about national security issues than many recent elections, certainly since right after the 9/11 attacks, and perhaps even going back to Cold War days, as people look at this ongoing conflict in Ukraine and the threat posed by China, among many other things. So that's why I think this subject of isolationism and what its role has been in U.S. politics over our history, and what its role is now and what its extent is, was worth taking on. But as I said, I'll stop there and say thanks again for the invitation, and would welcome your questions.
Well, with the sort of refreshing broad brushstrokes that you're producing, there are particular causes and questions where it comes. And one of the issues that's been in the undergrowth and in both Kiev and Washington is just what form of aid is there? Because friends of Ukraine point out that the Russians can pour missiles and weaponry in from the whole of the Eurasian landmass, whereas the weapons that are being supplied to the Ukrainian forces have a very limited range. So the Russians are not really paying a price. They can sort of, they have Ukraine besieged, and they can pound the Ukrainians, disable, as we've seen, their power supply, try to demoralize the citizenry. And I see there's no even pretense of winning hearts and minds. Winning hearts and minds does not mean raining scuds down on civilians in cities as a general rule. So Putin's not even pretending that, but except for domestic consumption. So are there concrete measures that you think the Biden administration has failed to, in terms of weaponry that they felt inhibited about providing to the Ukrainians for fear of provocation provoking Putin seems a bit... what type of concept is that? How much more can you provoke him?
let's be clear. He's the one who's provoked us. He invaded Ukraine. It didn't happen the other way around. And I think this is part of the confusion in the Biden administration's mindset. There's been a lot of self-congratulation, a lot of patting ourselves and NATO members on the back. But I think we have to understand, we have to go back to the beginning. We failed at the beginning. All of us. NATO failed, the United States failed, because we didn't deter the Russian attack. That would have been the outcome, the most desirable outcome, and Putin did not seem at all inhibited. We, on the other hand, have been deterred by him over the course of the last 10 or 11 months in several respects. The fear of provoking a general European war. I don't know who else Russia thinks they're going to attack. They're not making progress in Ukraine. How they think they're going to make progress somewhere else, certainly in conventional terms, I would like to see, which brings us to the second fear, the fear of Putin's threats on nuclear weapons, as to which we've had public testimony about this in the United States. We have seen no indication that his nuclear forces have undergone any change in their deployment to bring them to the point where that's a realistic threat. I always take nuclear weapons seriously, but I don't see them being on the table, at least until the point where Putin's regime itself is threatened. And while it's weaker than it was a year ago, it's not at the point, I think, where that's realistic. But we have been deterred by Putin. And that's why much of the alliance's aid to the Ukrainians has been a day late and a dollar short. And it has shown a lack of thinking about what our ultimate objective is and the strategy of how to get there. Part of that was excusable for a while because we thought the Russians were going to walk all over Ukraine. It's public knowledge that when American military and intelligence people briefed Congress a few days after the Russian invasion, they were saying, we think Kyiv will fall in another couple of days and the whole country in a matter of weeks. Remember, even before the invasion, we were talking about provisions for guerrilla forces in Ukraine that would harass the Russians after they had taken over the country. That's what people thought was going to happen. Probably the Russians did too. And when it turned out it didn't, and the provision of intelligence and weapons to the Ukrainians and their own fighting spirit and capabilities stalemated the Russians, we didn't move from the fear of losing entirely to developing a strategy of what we define as victory and how to win. So when we talk about, well, we should give ATACMS, having argued about whether we should give them HIMARS and argued about how many javelins we were going to give them and argued about whether they should get Polish MiG planes. All of these debates are consequential, but they have to be in aid of a strategy to make sense. And there's still no NATO strategy, with all due respect. I will say one unforeseen, at least by me, but potentially enormously significant consequence was the decision by Finland and Sweden to abandon their neutrality and join NATO. I think that's a huge win for the West, a huge loss for Russia. Now we have to do is overcome Turkey's frivolous objections and bringing NATO membership to Sweden and Finland will be a plus that will help us for a long time to come.
Well, sort of in the muddy side bywaters of the conflict, some of us were sweating a bit at the conflict in Kosovo, which almost certainly had Russian fingerprints on it. But somebody pulled, but it looks like the regime in Belgrade, the government in Belgrade, decided that they wouldn't play the Russian patsies, despite the pressure from the Serb nationalists in Mitrovica. How serious a threat was that? Because, of course, you know, Sarajevo is in the same region, and we all remember the consequences from 1914, or we should remember the consequences from 1914.
Yeah, well, I don't think we should let the war in Ukraine, as important as it is, distract us from Russian interference in the Balkans. They haven't changed in 100 years, and if not before. So I consider that the United States has not paid enough attention to the Balkans. I did get involved a little bit myself and in seeing if I could help Kosovo and Serbia work out their differences. That didn't work. But I think all of us in the North Atlantic ought to be on guard for Russian involvement, because it's not just Ukraine. We know, obviously, the risk of simply incorporating Belarus at a stroke is still there. You've still got Russian forces in Moldova. That remains a frozen conflict. And just in the past year, we've all heard about Russian efforts in a number of NATO members and in former Yugoslavia to cause trouble. So a sound defeat for the Russian aggression in Ukraine is important, obviously, first for Ukraine, but it's important across Eastern and Central Europe secondarily and across the world after that. There's nobody following the conflict in Ukraine more closely than the people in Beijing.
Well, Frank Gomez is following on from one of your points there. What are the isolationists hoping to do with Putin's expansionism? Trump and some Trumpists advocate a cozy hands-off approach, which basically means let him have what he wants, I presume.
Yeah. Well, you know, Trump could never decide really whether Finland or Ukraine or all those countries, it's all kind of fuzzy in his head. Maybe they were part of Russia to begin with, or why do we really care? And this is part of the mythology that if only we didn't pay attention to the rest of the world wouldn't bother us, which would be nice if we had not been the principal establishers of a global economy. I mean, there were plenty of other people involved, I acknowledge that, but we were the pushy people in the 19th and 20th century who did it because it made the American people richer, better off, living a higher standard of living than anybody in human history. And to say, well, we're just not going to be concerned with what happens some distance beyond America's borders leaves us hostage to that. I'm not saying every policy we've pursued in the past 50 years has been right. But if you want to have a strong American economy, you have to have a strong American presence in the world. And kissing even distant regions goodbye is not going to accomplish that.
Bill Holstein wants to know, what do you think the Chinese have concluded about the desire to invade Taiwan in view of the experience, Russian experience in Ukraine? Has it tempered their ambitions or encouraged them? Bill is a long-standing China watcher, of course.
Yeah, well, I think in terms of Beijing, the grade in Ukraine is incomplete. I don't have any doubt that that they're analyzing different pros and cons, but I also think that their desire to get Taiwan back under their control is very real. I think they are deterrable, however. They don't want to take over a heap of smoking rubble on Taiwan. They want, anybody who's been there knows this incredible mass of productive skills and human ingenuity there. They want all that functioning, especially the semiconductor chip fabrication facilities. We can deter China by making it clear that the cost of military action would be prohibitive. And there's just reporting today as we speak of a war game that showed China being defeated in an effort to invade Taiwan, but at very great cost to everybody. I think the bigger threat to Taiwan is strategic. And that's why I think that countries in the region and around the world should acknowledge reality. Taiwan is an independent country. And putting it into collective defense structures in the Indo-Pacific makes a lot of sense. I think what China would prefer would be to create some pretext of a crisis, throw a blockade around China, and see if the United States stands up to the blockade. And if we don't, then I think China has established hegemony over Taiwan, and eventually they get control of it. I think we can defeat that as well, but I think it requires an awful lot of thought. Deterrence is a word that's very easily used, but if you look at the experience of nuclear deterrence during the Cold War, it was a hard-fought argument for decades, and it came out okay in the end, but it wasn't easy to get there. And I think deterring China in the case of Taiwan, the Senkaku, Diaoyutai Islands in the East China Sea, the South China Sea, the land borders they have in South and Southeast Asia are all very complex issues, which we need to work on. But I do think they can be deterred.
Simon Locke is asking, how linked are Russia and China when it comes to Ukraine? And it says very, it's the Chinese are equivocating, obviously.
I don't think so, actually. I think the Chinese and the Russians have an entente going. I wouldn't call it a formal alliance yet, although it may be. It's not an axis yet, although it could be. With Russia is very much the junior partner, unlike in Cold War days. When the situation was reversed, I don't buy the argument that the Chinese are offended by this Russian behavior in Ukraine. Their poor delicate ears can't hear the complaints about what's happening in Ukraine. What the Chinese are upset about is Russian failure in Ukraine. That bothers them. They don't like weak subordinates. But I believe China has Russia's back. I think that the Russian financial institutions subject to Western sanctions are probably moving money through the very opaque Chinese financial system. I think China is more than happy to buy more Russian oil and gas. Even if they can't, if the Russians can't sell it in Europe, as India is buying more Russian oil and gas, unfortunately. And I think China is fully prepared to provide cover for the Russians politically at the Security Council. Putin and Xi had a conversation just before Christmas and still talk about expanding the framework of the alliance. I think if the Russians had wrapped this up in a couple of weeks in Ukraine, the Chinese would be a lot happier. But they're not going to separate themselves from Russia at this point. The Chinese are in the position they want to be, and things are moving in their direction politically.
I know it's one of your pet subjects as well, as we're looking at the distressful condition of women and dissidents in Tehran, in Iran at the moment. And Iran has sort of tipped its hand by providing weaponry to Russia, which might have lost it some support elsewhere, but obviously it sees big advantages. It doesn't need Russian oil, but Will they get more involved in the conflict? And beyond Ukraine, what can Western countries do to prevent the Iranian regime from continuing violence, executions? And he doesn't say, but I will add, weapons deliveries to Putin.
Yeah, well, this is Iran. This is the regime in Iran being the regime in Iran. It is a theocratic, militaristic dictatorship. For those like the Biden administration that are just beside themselves trying to get back into negotiation on the nuclear deal, this should be a point where they realize the nature of the regime is such that any agreement you make with them is not worth the paper it's printed on. I mean, the demonstrations that we've seen over the last 3 months, added on top of the widespread economic dissatisfaction that's been going on visibly in the public streets of cities and towns all over Iran for the past 6 or 7 years, most visible in 2019 when the government had to step in and repress it quite violently. These new demonstrations on top of that continuing dissatisfaction are aimed directly at the ideological legitimacy of the regime itself. This is not a dispute about dress codes. This is a dispute about whether the Ayatollahs legitimately channel the word of God that the mass of people have to obey. And 50% of the population, maybe it's only 49%, but a substantial chunk of the female side of the population have said, you're not channeling the words of God to us. We're going to wear what we want to wear. And as I say, it's not a dress code dispute. Once you break that lock on God's wisdom, you know, then people can actually have opinions. The justification for no democracy in Iran is, we know the word of God. How can you debate that? And the answer is, once they decide they can debate it, everything's on the table. So how do we end the Russian Iran axis? They're the Iranian aid to the Russians, all of their collaboration. The answer is clear. Overthrow the regime in Iran. Help the opposition. Find out what they need. Is it communications devices? Is it ways to break through Iranian interference with their access to the internet, their communication with the Iranian diaspora? Do they just need resources? What do they need? How can we be of help? The amazing thing about these demonstrations is there's no central coordination. There's no command and control. They happened across Iran effectively spontaneously. That's the good news. The bad news is they happen spontaneously and there's no central command and control. The regime has a monopoly of force at the moment, and the opposition needs help in overcoming that. Now, there's one thing about these protests that economic dissatisfaction doesn't have. Every general in the Iranian military and every general and every officer in the Revolutionary Guards has a mother. A lot of them, maybe almost all of them, have wives. A lot of them have sisters, and a lot of them have daughters. And you can bet you what they hear at home at night from all the female side of their family. That's why this is a direct threat to the regime. I'm not going to predict that the regime will fall in the next 30 days. No, nobody knows. And their propensity to use force, even against women and young people, should not be underestimated. But I think the regime in Tehran is under greater threat today than at any point since 1979.
Yeah, certainly the lack of popular legitimacy, which they did have in the past to some extent, is
That's not my view, but that's all right.
Well, it was a case of my enemy's enemy. The people who revolted against the Shah ended up with the Ayatollahs. And it's always a problem when you work on my enemy's enemy as a principle, of course. How about the Robert Papa's come back on Serbia? Well, you answered that. You saw Russian influence there. And when you were suggesting solutions in the Balkans, did you suggest land swaps there between the Albanian majority areas in Serbia and Mitrovica?
Well, I wasn't suggesting it myself. They were talking about it, and it proved politically impossible, first in Kosovo and then later in Serbia. But Tony Blair came to see me about this. He said, look, we have at that time leaders who might be able to work this out. And my reaction is the same as Jim Baker's when he was Secretary of State talking about the Arab is Israeli dispute, he said, we can't want peace more than the parties themselves. There's nothing, no solution we're going to impose on them. But if they work it out, we should accept it. Now, a lot of people don't like the idea of land swaps because it could destabilize other parts of the Balkans. The key point to bear in mind is that the land swaps they were talking about between Serbia and Kosovo were mutually agreed upon. As long as it's not imposed by force, mutually agreed land swaps can happen all the time. There's there was a longstanding dispute between Canada and Denmark over an island off the coast of Greenland, and they eventually worked it out. Amazing, and peace and stability.
The key point about that island, Ambassador, was it was uninhabited.
Well, you know,
there are actually people in Mitrovica. There are people, Albanians, who
used to live
there.
That's right. But they can be taken care of. And if the parties themselves work it out, the Europeans didn't like this idea, I said we would support it, and I still think that's right.
I was very pleased with the Danish Canadian détente. It really was two bald men arguing over an ice cube. So it didn't make much sense at all from the side of it. But two sensible parties can do it. But the parties involved aren't always sensible, as we've seen. And we were talking about the others. Getting back to China, they're revving up here. I love telling Chinese to refer to Edgar Allan Snow's interview with Mao Zedong in Red Star Over China, in which he says that Taiwan, Formosa, as he called it, should be allowed an act of self-determination after World War II to see what they wanted to do. And somehow that's has been missed from the canon of Mao Zedong's works.
Yeah, even Mao makes mistakes. How about that?
Mao nods, along with Homer. They're both sitting there nodding, no doubt. So, getting back into the US, I mean, you're one of the few people involved in American politics who gets involved in foreign policy. As very often in American politics, foreign policy is something you use as a hammer for domestic politics. You run a flag up a pole because you know it's going to get support. You're going to get the Polish vote or the Ukrainian vote or the pro-Israeli vote, whichever, because you hold the principle. It's not very often that, as you pointed out, we have strategic thinkers who think, well, this is what we should do both for our interests and for others. Is there any sign of that changing with the inadequacies of that approach to Ukraine becoming manifest and possibly in Taiwan as well?
Well, you know, it wasn't too far in the recent past. Certainly during the Cold War, foreign policy was the dominant subject. But I think when the Soviet Union collapsed, you'll remember in the early 1990s, people were talking about the end of history and the peace dividend, that we didn't need these large defense expenditures anymore. We should have woken up to that fantasy with the attacks on 9/11, but even that has grown remote in some people's minds. I just think 2024 looks like it will have more national security issues because of the unavoidable threat of China. People see it now. They understand it better. They're beginning to appreciate the extent of it. And I think it'll be interesting to see the coverage of the Kishida-Biden meeting on Friday. And I hope they do address the grand strategy. I'm not sure Biden's capable of it, but I certainly hope they do, because what Kishida did by saying he was going to double Japan's defense budget is like a fire bell in the night, and saying, we appreciate, we need substantial protection on our own. And it's the culmination of a 30-year-long debate in Japan over whether they're a normal nation or not. And they've decided, I think, quite rightly, they are a normal nation, and we should welcome that. Contrast that with Germany, where at the beginning of the war in Ukraine, Chancellor Scholz said we were having a sea change here in German policy, and that they would hit the 2% NATO target this year, 2023. They would spend 100 billion euros on defense material, including 30 billion for F-35s. And none of that has happened. And the 2023 target may now be 2025. I mean, the contrast between Germany, and I'll just add France for good measure on the one hand, and Japan on the other, is enormous. So I think this is a sign people are waking up to China. And I think it will, that's why it will be part of our debate.
Picking up on the German conundrum, Schulz made a nominal road to Damascus conversion, but he stayed on the back of his camel, headed straight ahead. I mean, he's been very diffident about vigorous support for Ukraine. And both he and Macron have this, what in historical terms is fetishistic belief in diplomacy as an end in itself, rather than reflection of material strengths on the ground. Why do you think this is? He's not a sort of Stasi sleeper. I don't think I do. But why is he being so diffident about this and equivocal?
Well, I think it may have to do with politics within the Social Democratic Party. I mean, they have said they're going to send tanks to Ukraine. Of course, we all could have done that about 10 months ago. The U.S. will send Bradley fighting vehicles. We could have sent them 2 months ago. This is part of what I was saying before about not having a strategy. Each incremental decision about additional weapon systems on its own merits looks pretty good. But where does it fit in terms of the strategy? And why these now? And why not earlier? And what comes next? That doesn't mean you have to give your playbook out in public or so the Russians can see what it is. But I think everybody would feel better if we understood what our objectives were, and at least in general terms, how to get there, which we don't see yet. And I think this is, in the case of Germany, you know, for example, their attitude toward China is also very important here. Do they see it as Japan and South Korea, increasingly in South Korea, Taiwan, Australia, India, the United States see it, or they just see China as a market? I mean, I think the pace is picking up here. I certainly hope Europe gets this point more broadly. I think the British are way ahead in that score than the Continentals.
Well, I tend to think that Germany sees China in as a commercial rival and possible partner, but rather than that they don't have the Far Eastern outlook that the China's neighbors might do. But how obviously Germany is crucial to events in the continent of Europe. If they might even have an influence on Hungary, for example. In Hungary, the government there has been completely maverick, as far as we can tell. Right. The descendants of the Arrow Cross, who had no compunction about sending Hungarian pro-Nazi troops into Ukraine, are now diffident about sending any aid at all.
Yeah, well, you know, it's it brings to mind is the famous Neville Chamberlain argument about the German Anschluss of the Sudetenland from Czechoslovakia. And Chamberlain said at one point, how remarkable it is that we're talking about a faraway country and a people of which we know little. Now, this is the difference between Prague and London, which is not very great. So you can say, well, China's a long way away. One of China's neighbors is invading Ukraine. And that's why this entente, this whatever this relationship is, that's my term for it, but whatever this relationship is between China and Russia, it's having an effect in Europe right now. So maybe in Berlin, they ought to consider that.
Well, since we've, like Teddy Roosevelt's great white fleet, we've circumnavigated the globe, we can come back to home harbor and ask some questions about the impending GOP elections. You have sort of hinted that if the candidates are also abysmal, you will put your hat in the ring for candidacy. Is that still, are you still holding your hat behind your back, ready to throw in?
Well, I'm still thinking about it now. I did an interview with a British TV station last week, and it's another demonstration. Never underestimate the inventiveness or creativity of the British press. I said the same thing I've been saying for about 6 weeks here. I'm considering whether to get in or not. And, you know, I did look at this very seriously in 2016. I mean, I went to Iowa, I went to New Hampshire. I took my family to New Hampshire to see how they'd like campaigning. I thought about what was involved and I decided not to run in 2016. So I start knowing how complex and arduous a decision like that is. And I'm not gonna take it lightly. But what got me thinking about it this year was when Trump said, some weeks back now, that he thought the Constitution ought to be terminated so that he could be declared the winner of the 2020 election. Now, you know, I filled out many security forms in my day and gone through many security clearance procedures. And one of the questions that, at least historically, they asked was, have you ever advocated the overthrow of the government of the United States? And I always happily answered no. But when you say, I want to terminate the Constitution, as Trump did, you are advocating the overthrow of the government of the United States. That was bad enough, but I was disturbed that the reaction of people who were generally considered to be potential candidates for the nomination did not give as strong a reaction to that as they thought they should. It's not enough to say, hey, look, I support the Constitution. It has to be that we affirmatively oppose anybody being a significant figure in the Republican Party who doesn't fully support the Constitution. That's what the president's oath says. It's written in the Constitution itself. The only oath that's written into the Constitution, the president has to commit to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, which manifestly Trump is not doing. That is a reason to run for president if I decide to do it.
Well, maybe Trump can join Bolsonaro in Orlando and they can discuss post-presidential strategies in future.
Yeah, this is not a good look in Brazil, I must say. And I think it's another reinforcement to Americans. This is what Trump caused on January the 6th. We don't need it again.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're drawing to our close now. Everybody, thank you very much. This is the Foreign Press Association in New York with Ambassador John Bolton and his New Year resolutions on foreign policy. But thank you once again, Ambassador Bolton. It's been, as usual, an invigorating, forthright, and informed discussion.
I think glad to be with you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you very much.